Hi everybody. How's everybody doing? Good. I just want to say I'm new to being a community health worker, and taking in the presentations from the past 2 days has been really inspiring for me. Just listening to the work that you all do is incredibly inspiring for me. And I just want to see a show of hands. Who in the audience works with families? Works with families. Okay. And who puts families in contact with resources? Okay, who's a community health worker? Okay, great. So I wanna talk about a project today that I was involved in this past year called Project Wings. And in this project, I served as a community health worker. Here's an outline of what I'm planning to cover today. I'm going to start with some background information to contextualize the project, then describe Project Wings. I'll give a case example to illustrate how the project increased health literacy, talk about the reception of the project, and then give some conclusions and recommendations. So I know there are numerous definitions of health literacy out there, but this one really struck me, especially in the context of Project Wings. It is as follows. Health literacy means more than being able to read pamphlets and successfully make appointments. By improving people's access to health information and their capacity to use it effectively, health literacy is critical to empowerment. So really, you're giving people the tools so that they can take more agency over their health outcomes. That's how I interpret it. So some background information. Going back to the title of my presentation, Sending Community Health Workers into the Homes of Struggling Latino Adolescents to Improve the Health Literacy of Their Parents, you might be able to infer that we were targeting Latino adolescents by working through their parents. The rationale behind the project mainly is that Latino adolescents have higher rates of depression, anxiety, suicidal ideation, and suicide attempts than white adolescents. Now, there are numerous reasons why this could be, numerous unique risk factors for this, and this is especially true for immigrant Latino adolescents. And looking at Project Wings, all of the families that we worked with were immigrant Latino families, and the vast, vast majority of their children were not born in the United States as well. So, explaining some of those risk factors, they include language barriers, language acquisition, the contrast between mainstream American culture that you might experience in the school and traditional Latino culture in the home, the clashes that, as some people were saying earlier, you know, there's like that switch in adolescence, and it switches on, and the clashes between the two cultures definitely can cause some stress in the home environment, and especially in the life of a Latino adolescent. When mental health care is needed for a Latino adolescent, there are oftentimes many barriers to actually accessing that care. Language, again, is going back to that. High costs of the high cost of receiving healthcare, lack of insurance, and then furthermore, there are sometimes fears and issues with citizenship status as well. In addition to that, past research has suggested that when Latino adolescents do seek mental health care, they are more likely to be seen by primary care providers than by mental health specialists. So now going back to the title of the presentation, working with the parents, past research has suggested that Latino youth turn to their parents for health-related information. So we decided we would work with the parents, targeting the Latino youth, and improve their health outcomes. Okay. Project Wings was a participatory collaborative project with the second largest public high school in St. Paul. Approximately 10% of the school, of the students, spoke Spanish as their primary language at home, roughly about 200 students in the school, Spanish speakers at home. There are a number of structures within the school that really facilitated the recruitment process during this project. There were monthly Latino parent involvement meetings that we would come to and present the project at that point, explaining what we would do and enrolling any parents that thought they might benefit from the project. We also worked closely with someone who was high up in the leadership department at the school, and he would regularly refer us to families who had agreed to release their information, and who had a struggling Latino youth in the school. So there were two community health workers in the project. I was one of them, and I represented the non-native Spanish speaker male, and my coworker represented the Spanish as a first language female community health worker. In total, we were able to recruit 22 parents. That's not a very big N, but when you think about the children, the net we cast actually becomes quite large. The majority of the parents and families were from Mexico. And like I said before, all families either self-identified or were identified by the school as having an adolescent who was struggling academically or exhibiting risk factors for substance use. I also included some demographics down at the bottom. Just to give you guys an idea, the majority of the families we worked with identified as being of low income. All right, I know this looks kind of goofy, and I will be filling in the numbers with some text in just a moment here. I want to describe how the project worked. So after the school referred us to a family, either myself or the other community health worker received their contact information, and we did a cold phone call to set up a home visit with them. Did the first home visit. At this point in time, we really just tried to introduce ourselves, the project, and establish a relationship, gauge the interest. We weren't trying to push any sort of an agenda down their throats. We did have a resource manual with educational topics that we thought we would cover during the course of the project, but we realized throughout the project that it's more important to meet the needs of a family than to stick to your agenda. You know, if you're trying to preach something about some sort of educational topic, and the family is struggling with food, it's not really going to go over incredibly well, and they probably won't stay in the project. So like I said, the assessment of needs was done at the first visit, as well as assessment of strengths. We really tried to talk with the parents and establish what they wanted to work on, what they thought was going well, and then we went forward from there. From this point, and I think this is what is most rich about this project, is that we would meet with the school staff and bring the context of the home environment to them, talk about what was going on at home, and then receive information about how the students were doing in school. We also had communication with the project manager and community health worker intercommunication. From this point, we developed a plan of action and then returned to the family. Approximately 2 weeks to a month later, it was usually bi-weekly or monthly, and followed up with them. So I want to give you guys a case example. I worked with, I think, 12 parents, and this mother, for the sake of the presentation, her name is Ana Maria. She was particularly, she'll always be in my memory because the first time I went and met with her, I remember her saying to me, just please help. Returning to what was said at an earlier presentation, I think she represented, I would say, Alejandra from one of the earlier presentations, the mother who had a lot of stress on her plate. She was a single mother of four. She reported to me at the first visit that she was suffering with depression and anxiety, and making matters worse, and in her opinion, causing these problems for the most part, was her adolescent son, who kind of was like a cheeky, returning to the previous presentation. Who had a history of mental health problems, substance abuse, and school suspensions. I studied psychology. I thought he was kind of, he would probably fit the definition of conduct disorder. So the home environment was very strained. He had three siblings and was emotionally and physically abusive to them. So an intervention was desperately needed, and I went to work. So returning back to this, I had the first home visit with Ana Maria. We assessed the needs. She wanted some sort of youth mentorship program for her son. I went and met with the school staff, talked with my project manager, and had a plan of action, and then returned for a follow-up home visit. So the first resource that we decided to put them in contact with was Big Brothers and Big Sisters. Mom became very involved in the process of selecting a big brother for her son. That's a great aspect of that program, is parents can be really involved in the selection process. her son got involved in that and started doing fun things with his big brother, and it actually worked out well for a little while. On later visits, I put them in contact with resources in the Twin Cities community that are called CLUES and La Familia Guidance Center. Both provide psychological counseling at lower reduced costs, specifically for Latino families. And then also the book, How to Talk to Teens So Teens Will Listen, or How to Talk So Teens Will Listen, How to Listen So Teens Will Talk. I know my mom read that book when I was a teen, and I kind of snickered at it, but I read it when I was in this project, and it's actually great. So we had a Spanish version of that, and a lot of the parents loved it. So we had a parent focus group at the end of this project to, you know, just get feedback. And Ana Maria has some important quotes, I think. She said, "I've put him in any program available, and there hasn't been a program that has been able to help me with him, and this program has helped me a lot. I liked it because it did give me a lot of help with resources that are available that you don't know about as a Hispanic. There is a lot of assistance here in Minnesota, and here in this program, they facilitate it for you." So returning to that definition of health literacy I said at the beginning of the presentation, it was really just equipping these parents with knowledge of resources in the community, and they took advantage of it from there. In the case of Ana Maria and her son, things improved for a little while. He was very actively involved in the Big Brothers program, but things kind of turned south. And you know, some people from the outside perspective might say it was a negative outcome, but he actually ended up going to kind of a boys town school in Iowa. And for the family, it was a positive outcome. Mom was incredibly less stressed at the end of the project and was moving forward and reported that her son was doing well. So it was good. I have some more quotes from participants. We received overwhelmingly positive responses at this parent focus group. You can see in this quote, people expressing or wishing that this project would be available for every year and in every school district. I love this quote because I worked with this family and the husband was very reluctant to participate at the beginning, but at the end he was very active in it, and his wife is kind of quoting that right there. This quote is in relationship to the book I explained earlier. And this quote right here has to do with a food shelf that I put a family of 11 children in contact with. It was just about 4 blocks away from their house, a Salvation Army, and they weren't aware of the resource. So they were below the poverty line, and putting them in contact with this resource definitely helped their situation. So as a whole, this project increased literacy. The first 5 I have up here on this list indicate increases in health literacy. We put parents in contact with substance abuse programs such as Alcoholics Anonymous, mental health services I mentioned, CLUES and La Familia earlier, free clinics, youth mentorship programs such as the Big Brothers and Big Sisters, and food shelves. Other things we did with families included bringing them to libraries to get them oriented to the public library system, getting everybody a library card. That opened up a wealth of information and resources, the transportation system as well. So in conclusion, this community health worker home visiting model is promising as part of a collaborative team approach to reach families of at-risk Latino youth, promote family health literacy, promote adolescent well-being and school success, and improve parent and adolescent relationships. Prior to this conference, we were just getting back some of our initial data analysis, and early results indicated that parent and adolescent relationships improved on certain measures. And like I said at the beginning of this presentation, it's important to work with parents, at least in the Latino community, because they are the key facilitators of health-related information to their children. Future research of this nature should continue to do home visits, especially in this community. We were welcomed in with open arms for all of these home visits, and it was ideal for promoting health literacy. One thing that future research could improve upon is including some sort of measure of health literacy. We didn't have the the foresight when we created this project to include any sort of measure. We really, at its onset, wanted to improve parents and adolescent relationships, but we noticed throughout the project that we were having an impact on health literacy as well. And then for me, just kind of a conclusion, as someone who wants to pursue a medical education in the future, hearing these presentations the past 2 days on community health workers and their importance, I've really realized that as a physician in the future, it's important to take advantage of the resources that community health workers provide. So that's it. Thank you all.
Thank you, Evan. Thank you, Evan, and all the presenters on this panel. If you have questions, we'd be happy to take them. Yes.
Thank you very much for all the new people hearing me out this morning. I'm interested in the film. I want to know about the budget, the funding, where you got it.
Soap opera. This film, it was funded by the Colorado Law Foundation.
I have a question up here. Thank you. Yes, sir.
Yes, I just wanted to ask, I know that the PBS always has DVDs about the series that they do for the show. Is there any series for your program?
This year, so we did this, it aired in 2009, the first time, and now it's airing for the second time, the same show. And now it's airing in Univision and PBS. And I've been here locally, and it's also in the internet. So all the episodes you can see now in the internet, and you can we can get all kind of data. So you can get them. We don't have the actual DVD waiting because the Colorado Health Foundation owns the production, and we're still trying to figure out how that's going to be disseminated to the other clinics because that's the impact that we want.
It's nice to see that you guys have lifted up the news. A lot of times people don't, really watch PBS, so.
It's there in the PBS, too. And also, again, because of the internet, we're able to have access to
Thank you. Kathy?
I really appreciate hearing all of the presentations this morning. They were all such fabulous aspects. I really like that, especially the Martin. I didn't want to call Martin. The utilizing technology to reach lots of people. That's just fantastic. But I'm not quite sure how to approach this, so I'm just going to throw it out there. There's, in the Delta presentation, in terms of the measurements and the indicators, the use of the word non-conforming was in there. And our CHRs have raised this to our providers, because we are literally having a huge paradigm shift in the Indian health system from a doctor-driven, doctor-dominated medical model to a patient-centered, and patient-centered is first, medical home, medical incorporated community-based providers as well. The point you brought up about the use of the label non-compliant is that, you know, these are usually adults we're talking about, and it's like you're in school, you know, it's like the doctor's like this. And so the things that we're moving towards, looking at those problems, and that are helping our providers actually get better sleep at night, and giving them specific tools that we're trying to help our CHRs with as well, are those kinds of motivational interviewing techniques. And we're just getting started with this with CHRs because they kind of intuitively do it already. They just don't know that that's what it is. But also training providers as well to really utilize those kinds of skills, to provide CHRs providing self-management support, but to help identify those social determinants of care, why that person is really non-compliant under our labels, and to try to understand what's going on in that home as to why they're not taking the meds. You know, is it they're getting stolen? Their, you know, grandkids are coming in and selling it? Is it that they don't know really how to take it? I mean, that's really an issue because, you know, as CHWs and our CHRs would go into a doctor and a patient setting, and the doctor's going, okay, you can do this, this, and this. Walk out, and I mean, everybody's heard this. And this patient will turn to the person and go, what is that? Or what she said? Yeah, and they have to explain
I understand fully what you're saying, having managed primary care clinics in our past in the Delta because the clinics are such high volume clinics, and providers that really do have OR tend to quickly say they're non compliant. And I guess that's one thing that we're looking. You know, there are issues that are causing them to be non-compliant. Often it's certainly not because they just don't want to take their medicine there.
Right.
And so Liz's projects and ours are really, you're exactly right, it's one of them just not, why are they not compliant?
One of the things that we're learning from the IHI, the Student Healthcare Improvement Partnership that we've got in is the UK model that they're using as well, where they're actually utilizing, partnering with community health workers and peers to have the physicians actually come in and sit in there. And at the beginning of, you know, it's a relationship-driven process. But I would encourage you to, as you're looking at that and struggling with it, to talk to those CHWs and ask their suggestions, because they will give you good suggestions if you give them that opportunity. And they'll have great ideas on unique strategies that maybe it's kind of out of the box, but it's exactly what's needed. So I just wanted to bring that up because, you know, in our system, that's been a huge, huge divide. Well, this person's not compliant, so they're dismissed. And that shouldn't be. And our CHRs have brought that up. Yes. They're labeled.
Yeah, that's exactly the example of what has happened in the Delta and understanding the pressure that the providers are on. Some of them are seeing 68 patients a day. Take someone that is normal, they're irritated, they've been visual bad for a while. It's just easy to label a person non-compliant, move on to the next patient that they feel like is trying.
I wonder if I wonder if I could do a follow-up question, because there was something, Kathy, that also I found disturbing, or I just couldn't understand about that model. And that was the interest in comparing, and I think this speaks to what we value in this country and this healthcare system and what we're willing to pay for, I don't understand this, and maybe you can help me understand it. The interest in documenting differences between paid CHWs and unpaid CHWs. I don't see anybody evaluating paid nurses and unpaid nurses. So,
yeah,
paid patient navigators or paid doctors or not paid doctors. What is the interest in labeling CHWs or identifying CHWs by volunteerism or not pay? Right?
And that's a discussion that Dr. Sherrington really goes into detail in her commentary. The difference, when you talk about the strengths and weaknesses of both models, for instance, if a CHW is paid and is part of a healthcare system, then the community sometimes might view them as having divided loyalties, whereas a volunteer is strictly seen by some individuals as totally aligned with the community and an advocate for the community. So that's just because of the literature and what I've read is a reason that I refer to it as comparing them. What we're seeing so far is that the community health workers in both situations are very effective. You know, needless to say, a paid community health worker will be able to, you will expect them to be able to keep more documentation, whereas the volunteer, you know, you really can't expect them to do a lot of documentation. Some may be willing to, but there are differences in the two models. But again, a place for both in assisting the healthcare team.
Yeah, I really, not really, because I mean a CHW, you know, it's not up to an institution to decide who a CHW is. We are a standard occupational category. The Department of Labor has described who we are. We have very discrete and described roles and tasks. And whether we're paid or not, those roles and tasks are the same. And I don't.
Paid or not, they're the natural helpers and mm-hmm. doing what the other CHW does. The controversy is not my controversy, mm-hmm. and it's not a different distinction that I've made. It's what we have seen in the literature, and that's why I pointed out Dr. Charrington's article that you might want to take a look at, and that was Ethnicity and Disease, a journal. And it's in spring 2010.
Yes, ma'am. Yes. Yeah. We're already behind. We're 5 minutes late. If you want to stay and have discussions, but I can't hold the whole audience. Thank you very much, and safe travels to everyone.